Hello, and welcome to the Degree of Freedom podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber, and if you're not familiar with it, Degree of Freedom is my one-year project designed to push massively open online courses and other forms of free learning to the limit by trying to see if it's possible to learn everything you get from a four-year liberal arts degree in just 12 months using only no-cost learning resources. The project began on January 1st, and by December 31st of this year, I'm planning to take the equivalent of 32 full-credit college-level courses that meet the distribution and major requirements of a degree in my chosen field, which, in case you're interested, is philosophy. The purpose of this project, beyond keeping me off the streets, is to gain exposure to every aspect of college-level online learning, including MOOC classes provided by companies like Coursera, edX, and Udacity, as well as self-paced resources available from places like MIT OpenCourseWare, Sailor, and iTunes U. If you like, you could think about Degree of Freedom as a set of experiments within the broader MOOC experiment designed to see how much one can learn without being enrolled in a traditional college program. And determining what you can learn from free classes is at the heart of this experiment. For when I first started learning about MOOCs, is it possible that they've only been dominating the educational media airwaves for the last 2 years? It struck me that many of the arguments I seemed to be reading were premature. Do MOOCs really mean the death of the traditional university? Should you get real college credit for going through one? Are they designed to flip the classroom to the point where tenured professors will turn into serfs who do the grunt work for a bunch of rock star professors who are only seen in a web browser? Each of these questions, which are primarily about asking what you should earn for taking a MOOC class, miss the more important point of what you learn by taking a MOOC class. Is it the equivalent of being in a college class? More? Less? How can we tell? Taking just one course won't give us all the answers we need, nor two, nor probably even 32. But going through the variety of experiences needed to gain at least an approximation of a full-fledged degree program should at least provide a perspective that can inform the discussions we're having on what to do with these new and intriguing learning resources. Now, getting this information into the conversation involves a number of different mechanisms. First off, if you visited the degreeoffreedom.org website, you'll find regular weekday postings on various aspects of MOOCs and other forms of free learning, from an analysis of the different components of a course, such as lectures, reading, and homework, to deep dives into issues such as assessment and economics of MOOCs. This higher-level analysis is supplemented by a weekly Degree of Freedom newsletter built around a detailed review of whatever course I just finished, accompanied by a brief report on my project status and discussions of issues in the news related to free learning. But this conversation was never meant to include just one voice, which is why I've dedicated this podcast to interviews with thought leaders in the MOOC movement and other people doing interesting things with free learning. Each week, I plan to host someone leading or blazing new trails in independent learning, from presidents and founders of MOOC companies, to teachers who have had different experiences in online instruction, to students with learning experiences different than the one I'm having. And for this first broadcast, we're joined by Anant Agarwal, president of edX, who could tell us about the MIT-Harvard consortium he leads that is dedicated to bringing the best university-level courses to the world. Anant Agarwal, welcome to Degree of Freedom.
Hey, my pleasure, John.
Now, I think most listeners will be familiar with edX, but can you provide us details about your background and how you came to run the organization?
So in terms of my own background, I was the director of the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at MIT, or CSAIL. My own background is in electrical engineering and computer science. I'm a professor at MIT. I've been there for over 25 years. My research has been in chip design, computer architecture. I've also been a serial entrepreneur, being involved in a number of companies, starting with Virtual Machine Works to also a company called Tylera, which is a leading multi-core chip company that my group and I founded out of MIT several years ago. The way we got going with this was, you know, as we began doing online education, we launched MITx on December 19th of 2011. Harvard came on board as a partner. We renamed it edX on May 2nd of 2012. So our birth date will actually be tomorrow. And we have a number of world-class partners. You know, our mission is to really dramatically increase access to education for students around the world while reinventing our own campus experience through research. We have some just great partners from around the world, such as Berkeley, the UT system, Georgetown, and others that offer courses on our platform. We have some of the best courses in the world taken by students all over the world. And you know, we have about 900,000 students from 192 countries on our platform right now.
And I got the email announcing that one-year anniversary. So first, congratulations.
Thank you.
And second, it's kind of amazing to think about how much has happened in 1 year, and also realize that 1 year represents close to half the history of the whole MOOC phenomena. So what are some of your highlights from the last 12 months?
So I think, you know, if you look back on the past 12 months, you know, we launched with one course in spring of last year. We went up to about 10 courses in the fall, and we have about 30 courses right now, going up to close to 100 courses in the fall of this year. But much more than the numbers, I think what's important is the extraordinary changes we've been able to make in both the quality of the courses, in the kind of things that we can offer courses on, and also the ways in which we can impact campus education and the research that we're doing. So in terms of courses themselves, we've been able to create a bunch of new technologies that if you'd asked me a year ago, hey, look, is this going to be possible? I would have said that seems like rocket science to be done. But the number of things that we're doing today that really improve the learning experience and we're experimenting with. So as one example, one of the biggest things we've learned is that one of the key reasons why MOOCs scale to large number of students is the community aspect. Where the, you know, on the discussion forum, students from around the world, now millennial generation, who are very comfortable asking questions online and working online, answer each other's questions and really enables us to scale on the discussion forum, something we simply had not realized when we how important that was when we began the whole movement. Now, we had a discussion forum on our platform even in our very first course, so we knew it was good, but did not know how critical it was. We also have a number of humanities courses on our platform, and humanities courses introduce technological challenges that we've been able to address. So, for example, how do you grade preform content like essays and paragraph answers and so on? And for that, we've developed technologies of AI assessment, peer assessment, and self-assessment that enable us to grade essays. It's still experimental, but I think we'll keep improving over time. And then for the humanities subjects, there's also a huge need for how do you create kind of a small group feel, a small group discussion feel. And for that, our team has invented cohorts, which is a way of dividing up a large discussion forum into smaller discussion groups where students can talk amongst each other in a smaller setting, and the instructor can create these smaller groups. And over time, we will have algorithmic ways to create these groups based on geography or capacity and things like that. And so that's another thing we invented. We simply had not realized a year and a half ago, one, that it was useful, and second, that even if you realize it, you know, how do we do this? So our team has been able to tackle some of these big challenges and overcome them. So we've come a long way in terms of what's possible on the platform. We're also impacting campus education. So all the universities partnering with us are using the platform on campus as well. And we're seeing a huge uptake of the blended model of learning on campuses. Just as one example, at MIT, over 1,300 students, about 25 to 30% of the undergraduate body is using the edX platform in some form in their courses. Berkeley, for example, taught blended classes using the edX platform, where students did exercises and homeworks and so on using the platform. So there's a lot of uptake of the platform on campuses, as well as people experimenting with the blended model. So we've really come a long way in this short span of 1 year.
It's interesting because I've actually enrolled in a couple of edX classes, actually two of your Harvard X classes, Justice and Greek Hero. And while they're both delivered on the same platform, they really seem very different from one another. And they both seem very wired into the philosophy of each particular professor. I've gotten the impression that there's a sort of level of individual craftsmanship that goes into each edX course. Could you tell us a little bit about how the courses are put together?
Sure. I think I'm glad you noticed that. With the edX, we're trying to build a platform that is flexible and very high quality, and you know, trying to do it in a way that professors and universities, for that matter, can put their own imprimatur on their courses and make them look and feel and have the level of quality that they care about. And so I'm not surprised that many of the courses are very different from each other, that they're all not identically looking cookie cutter courses. Just as one example, we have an authoring platform called edX Studio. Think of it as GarageBand for courses. The professors use as an authoring platform to construct a course. This is one example of the flexibility. A professor can construct a course like a regular course in a university by week, or they can construct a course more with a textbook feel to it using chapters. Now, what is interesting is that in the Greek Heroes course, they did neither and made it based on hours. And so I myself am struck by the creativity of the professors and how they're using the tools and technologies and doing very different things. Even if you look at courses, a Berkeley course will look different. Professors may use some combination of lecturing in classrooms with tablet capture. They may do some kind of demonstrations. UT Austin course might look different. So really, we're trying to create a platform where professors can be creative and yet still have enough support from the platform to be able to get a high quality course together.
And understand there's also a research component that's associated with every edX course. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of research you're working on and what, if anything, you've discovered so far?
So we think of edX as the particle accelerator for learning, and where we're gathering huge amounts of data as students learn. Think of it as big data for learning. And we share data in anonymized form with our partner universities, and they are doing a lot of research with the data. So all our universities get to share the data. Just as one example, in a variety of courses, as the data is gathered, first of all, many professors are using the platform to gather data. You know, as an example, the public health course from Harvard, which was a course on epidemiology and biostatistics, which has to do with human behavior, to gather data. They did a survey of all their students. They had over 60,000 students from all over the world, and they gathered data from students by taking surveys and so on. And so, and the students used that data to actually study and investigate epidemiology and biostatistics. And that's sort of data in the course. And we also gather student learning data. And just as one example, Professor Pritchard at MIT has done some research using edX data, where the question he was trying to answer was something that we all grappled with as instructors. You know, I've been teaching for 25 years, and I've never known until today, you know, what resources are students using when they do homework? What resources are students using when they do an exam? You know, do they go and listen to my recorded lectures? Or do they do read the textbook? You know, how much time are they spending on each of these resources when they're doing various activities? We have no idea. And so what he discovered is that when students are doing homeworks, they actually use videos quite a bit, and they use the discussion forum to discuss amongst themselves. However, when students do an exam, they're actually making a lot more use of the textbook. I think as the next, so here's some data, and as a next step, I think it'd be interesting to see why. Just as one example, there's a lot more research going on. This is just one example of something that we're able to discover, and then I can see follow-on research trying to see, once you know how students are using material and students behaving, can we tailor the course to optimize their own learning experience? So I can imagine this is sort of an ongoing organic system that we keep improving as we learn more.
Right now, I've heard the term experiment used in almost every conversation about MOOCs, and it seems like each course itself is sort of part of an ongoing
experiment.
Absolutely.
The whole MOOC movement is an experiment. And I think, as we, even in universities and so on, that's a place where students come to learn and where, we do research. And so therefore, it's not unusual that what we do should always be an experiment where we're trying to keep trying new things and be innovative, trying to improve ourselves. And if some things didn't work, move on to something else. But keep experimenting and trying to improve. And certainly the whole MOOC movement and the way we see things at edX is that of a big experiment where we are trying to improve learning in general, trying to improve learning on campuses and also increase access to education around the world.
You mentioned as part of that sort of experimentation, kind of looking at how students are working on assignments and homeworks and tests and such. Something I've talked about a lot on the Degree of Freedom site is how MOOC courses compare to one another and to equivalent courses taught in traditional classroom. And there seems to be very wide variation regarding workloads associated with each course. I've heard of some courses that are extremely demanding and designed to be such, whereas others I've taken seem to be more designed to expose students to material, and they don't want to place high barriers. So the assignments, while still challenging, don't feel quite as demanding as they would in a traditional course. And I guess, just any thoughts on how much MOOCs compare to traditional brick and mortar classes, and should we be making that comparison?
First of all, let me preface my comments by saying that I think having courses that at all levels of rigor, I think, are important so that all cadres of learners can access the courses. And that said, on edX, we try to create courses and have our faculty and university partners create courses that match campus rigor. So if you take an MITx course, professors and MITx and edX will work hard to make sure that the course matches the rigor of a similar course on campus. And there's also a level of quality. So for example, in a circuits class that came out of MITx, my colleagues and I who instructed that course, and the engineering team that developed the engineering mechanisms tried to match campus rigor. So as an example, a campus laboratory is a big part of the course. So we have online labs and virtual laboratories on edX in a number of courses, which is a key ingredient that is required to match campus rigor. And there are other courses that on a variety of MOOC platforms and take courses maybe which are less rigorous. And just want a quick introduction. edX also has a number of students which are in there for self-study. They might not care too much about doing the exams or go for a certificate. They just want an introduction to the subject. So I think getting courses over time that are at varied levels would be very useful. And you're right, the courses are indeed at various levels. And I think to first order, certainly on edX, given that we try to match campus rigor, the courses in many respects reflect kinds of courses that you might see on campus of a part.
And speaking of the students sort of enrolled for different reasons, it seems that there's a lot of talk about the percentage of people who are finishing a course, but it struck me that there's not enough detail in terms of who's enrolling for a course and why, who's auditing it, who's shopping around to see if they want to take it, who sort of is interested in getting to the end but doesn't make it, who's interested in getting to the end and making it. So is there enough data in yet to sort of give a sense of the 100,000 people who enroll for a popular edX course, sort of what percentage are there just to sort of expose themselves material, maybe audit the class?
When students enroll, we do ask them for a fair bit of data. So when you signed up for edX, you would have provided a fair amount of data as you got in, well beyond your login name, such as, you know, your geographical location, what is the educational background, you know, why are you doing this? And so we use that data to learn about our student population, to understand what the motivations are and so on. So this way we can understand our population base better. And so based on that, we do have a lot of data. We also take surveys during classes and so on to understand the background of students who are taking each of the classes as well. And there might be class-specific surveys. And so what we're finding, just as one example, then the result, this is the results from last year, and things vary. We found that about 5% of our students were high schoolers at that time. About 45% of our students were college age, 18 to 25. And then about 50% of our students were what you might call continuing learners beyond the age of 25. And so the students beyond the age of 25, continuing learners, you know, they may be in there, you know, not to advance their school curricular prospects, but maybe looking for self-study or maybe looking to move to a better job, replenish their skills. Early students in high schools are very eager to do this because their certificates can be used to get them placement into a top university. So as an example, a number of edX students who did really well in the spring edX course in circuits applied to MIT, and they got admission into MIT. So there's one student, Amol Bhave, for example, from Jabalpur in India, who did really well in the edX course. And he also created a website to offer a follow-on course on it himself. And he got admitted to MIT, and he's going to be coming to MIT in the fall of this year. So we have a number of students taking the courses at various ages and with very different motivations. And we have a fair bit of data on why students are doing this, and it can vary by course.
And variation by where they're taking the course?
30% of our students are from the U.S. About 13% are from India. Number three is U.K. at about 4%. And Brazil is number four at about 4% as well. Colombia is very high, and it's right up there. So we have data on how many students are taking courses. And it's what is interesting is that the geographical distribution also differs by course. So, for instance, in a public health course taught by Harvard, the single largest population of students came from India. So there were more students from India than from the U.S. in that course. So it's very interesting to see the demographics, and they keep changing by course.
You just mentioned students who are taking these classes and using them as part of their enrollment. A lot of the debate on MOOCs is centered around whether they should count for college credit, whether they should be, there should be mechanisms developed to allow students to use them in lieu of a certain number of credits at a brick-and-mortar college.
We do have a lot of students that do care about their campus credit because they are taking a rigorous course. And on edX, the courses are rigorous. So they are the match campus rigor. So the student passes the course, they get a certificate of mastery. edX maintains a copy of that certificate. Each certificate contains an identifier that an employer can type into a browser and verify the authenticity of the certificate. And so these are valuable certificates for students. And so the question is, you know, many students are interested in credit, and edX is looking at a number of ways in which to do this. First of all, one of the things that edX does is licenses courses to other universities. So as an example, San Jose State University licensed an edX course in the fall. It's a circuits course. We announced about a month ago, the Cal State system is looking to license a number of courses, the same course across a number of campuses across the Cal State system. So there, those campuses are giving credit for the course, and they gave credit for the students who passed the course at San Jose last semester. A second form of credit is that a number of our university partners have indicated that they're interested in giving campus credit for these courses. And we're also working with third parties that are evaluating our courses, either for credit equivalency, such as, you know, ACE, American Council on Education, where they evaluate a course of credit equivalency. But there, you know, the students would have to find a university that is willing to give credit. a number of our students have been able to talk to the universities directly, and they've gotten credit from the university once they've checked out the rigor of the course. So I think people have begun to get credit, and I think over time we will see more and more of it.
You mentioned that edX is going from 30 to 100 classes, and I know you've already kind of broken away from the roots of the MOOC project, which were more geared around technical and computer science classes. As you double and triple your course load, is it spreading out?
We announced 5 courses from UT now a couple of weeks ago. Indeed, the courses span a range of disciplines from humanities to business to science. There's a course on the science of cooking from HarvardX this fall as well. So there's a whole range of courses that will be coming out. You know, the justice course is going on right now. It's a Mike Sandel course. So there'll be a number of courses. I don't know the exact ones, but certainly we already have a number of humanities courses. There will be a lot more in the fall.
I really appreciate the time you spent with us.
Yeah, fantastic. I look forward to seeing good things from Degree of Freedom.
That was Anant Agarwal, president of edX. Now, before this week's podcast comes to a close, I'd like to finish up by talking a little bit about what this project is and what it isn't. First off, keep in mind that I'm part of that majority of edX students Anant mentioned who already has a degree, a BA in chemistry, as a matter of fact, meaning my perspective is that of a lifelong learner versus an 18-year-old comparing online to traditional classroom education. The fact I've already gone through an undergraduate experience means I have something to compare my current crop of classes to with regard to how much I've learned. But for insights into what this might mean for people closer to my kids' age than my own, we'll have to turn to some of the younger guests who will be joining us over the coming weeks, folks who are working on their own experiments in independent learning. People encountering this project have also wondered if a one-year BA is some kind of gimmick and asked how much I can actually be learning working at such a frantic pace. This is a legitimate question since I would no doubt be getting more out of my classes if I spread them out over 3 to 5 years versus just 12 months. But I can assure you that every class I'm enrolled in has been or will be taken to completion, meaning I've listened to all the lectures, completed all the readings, and done all of the assignments needed to obtain a passing grade, as well as optional assignments that don't impact my grade one way or another. Now, it may be that some MOOC classes are easier than their brick-and-mortar equivalents, which is why performing the same experiment inside a traditional classroom-based program would likely be more difficult to pull off. But even with brick-and-mortar, you've got some classes that are more demanding than others. And regardless of your learning environment, it's often the student's choice to throw themselves into a class or just do the minimum. Which is why, at the end of the day, learning has to be the key metric used to evaluate whether or not a class has been successful. While there'll no doubt be additional questions about or even objections to my approach to this project over the course of the year, keep in mind that as this podcast you are listening to and the degreeoffreedom.org blog and newsletter I hope you'll decide to read, which are the most important outputs of the Degree of Freedom project. For only by providing a perspective informed by student-centric experiences can legitimate issues of what works and what doesn't in an online learning environment be surfaced and addressed. And with that, I'd like to call it a podcast, but not before inviting you to join me next time when our guest will be Andrew Ong, co-founder of Coursera. So thanks, and I hope you could stop by for the next Degree of Freedom podcast.